My name is Sandy Silverman, and I want to wish you welcome to the class of 1984's panel on cultivating wellness in an increasingly unhealthy society. Thank you.
Thanks. Sorry. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah. It's not what I do normally. And I want to introduce you to our moderator, Robin Gottdenker-Smith. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sandy. So welcome to this panel, Cultivating Wellness in an Increasingly Unhealthy Society. Wellness requires that individuals live and function well in body, spirit, and community. Today, we're going to hear from three members of the class of 1984 about how wellness practices inform their professional and personal lives, and hopefully learn how we can improve our own wellness practices so that we not only live longer, but continue to nurture a life worth living. I'm Robin Smith, née Gottdenker, and I'm a 27-year pediatrician in a small private group practice. In pediatrics, we often practice by the motto of healthy until proven sick. So I spend a lot of my day trying to educate kids and families about staying healthy and living healthfully. Now to our panelists. Dr. Dan Javitt was a practicing physician for over 30 years, performing invasive procedures at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City. He has now become a certified health and wellness coach to help others discover the inner resources necessary to promote their own health, happiness, and well-being. Dr. Sarah Stackpole was a surgical ENT who in 2010 suffered career-altering meningitis, and now with her certification in acupuncture and newfound awareness of the interplay between physical and mental health, is returning to a non-surgical ENT practice. Eileen Sussman-Rosen has her master's in education and is a certified yoga therapist and co-author of two books, Comprehensive Yoga Therapy, Attending to Your Whole Self and Yoga, Attending Your Whole Self, and Yoga and Mindfulness for Young Children. Before we begin hearing in more detail from our panelists, we wish to start with a living example of the types of wellness practices about which they will be preaching. Eileen?
So we were talking about whether you all need to be calmed down or brought up. Can I bring it with me?
Yeah, it moves.
Oh, you can go up here.
It moves.
You can just look at me. So I'm going to ask you all to stand up. I know your space is limited, but I'm going to ask you to take a big breath in and raise your arms up over your head. If you can't go sideways, you can go forwards or even like this. If your shoulders are up near your ears like mine, drop them down while your hands are up and just breathe in, filling your lungs as much as you possibly can, and breathe out at your natural pace. As you breathe in, try to draw the breath down to the bottom of your lungs, which goes right down to your diaphragm, and fill to the top and out. Come in one more time. You can lower your arms as you exhale this time. And now, as you're standing, really feel your feet on the floor. Actively press your feet into the floor. Make sure you're standing up straight. And this time, as you inhale, try to expand your belly. And then exhale fully, contracting your belly back toward your spine. Do that a couple more times. And then you can take your seats.
Thank you, Eileen. I'm going to begin by asking each of our panelists to share, how did you get into the field of health and wellness, and how do you use it both personally and professionally? I think we'll just go down the line in order. Dan, do you want to start?
Okay, sure. Hello, everyone. Great to be here with you all. So my story really begins at about the age of three. And before you worry about this, you know, this old geezer going on forever, I have 6 minutes, so you're all good, so you can relax. But honestly, at the age of three, this is my first memory, was that my mother was reading me a book, and you know, Lord knows why this was the book, but in the book, like, one of the bunnies dies. And I said to her, like, she could tell, like, my facial expression changed, and she said, like, is everything okay? And I said, Mommy, am I gonna die? And for those of you who know my mother, she didn't sugarcoat it. She's like, yeah, definitely, you're going down. Like, could be any time, you know? And so there I was, like, all my friends are, like, happily, you know, three-year-old friends are happily playing in their feces, and I'm, like, having my first existential crisis. Like, I'm gonna die, and, like, you know, don't know what that even means. So, but honestly, that actually did have a big impact on me. It's my first memory, and I remember that. I said, well, you know, in my three-year-old brilliant mind, I said, you know, if you get sick and then you die because you're sick, I'll become a doctor, figure out the ways to cure all the sicknesses, and I won't die. So, you know, I'll let you know how that goes, but but that is the way I was thinking, and it really did, you know, made me think about health and well-being from a very early age, and how can I, you know, extend my life. It's so I became a doctor, and we'll fast forward decades. And but what happened in my practice was I was an interventional radiologist. I did minimally invasive procedures, and they're often done in patients who are too sick to go to the OR because I would do it under sedation. So a lot of the patients I was getting are very, very sick, and very often I do procedures, and it may, you know, a lot of them were end-stage cancer, dialysis, very sick patients who didn't do very well, and I was just thinking how inefficient this was, that I'm spending all this time, energy, and, you know, financially, could put $150,000 into somebody who might be dead in 2 weeks. I had this one patient who actually was a smoker, 50 years, no surprise, large lung tumor, came to me. I put some probes in his chest. I burned the tumor. His lungs were emphysematous. They were like tissue paper. They just collapsed, and he was in the ICU and died a month later. And I was like, and he probably spent over $1 million on this one patient alone. And I was thinking, what if I caught this guy when he was like 22 years old, and he was like trying to decide, should I smoke or not, or what can I get away from this, and proactively promote health rather than retroactively manage disease. And so right there, my alignment with what I was doing was not very strong. At the same time, I had a very unusual situation. There's only two of us in this practice, so I was on call 26 weeks a year, and that's like unheard of. Usually there's 4 or 8 or 10 people in a practice. And because of it, I was on call all the time, going to the hospital. And every time, you know, I was out with my family or trying to relax or recover from the work I was doing, I'd get called in. And the more fun the event was, the more likely it was I would get called in. So I'm at a Giants game, I'm going in, right? Old Timers Day, Yankee Stadium, went in. And I remember I was having sangria with some friends, really enjoying myself. And I got called in actually to do a procedure that I had never done before on Leonard Nimoy. And that, you know, for those who knew me from TD, I was Toucan Dan. So you can imagine how that went. As you know, he's no longer with us.
all people
anyway,
die, Dan.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you guys can do the math there. So bottom line, what happened was I was really unhappy at work, and I was working hard, and I wasn't aligned with my passion. So I went away. I didn't know what to do with this, but I went away to a place called Rancho La Puerta, which is this wonderful spa, health and wellness retreat, really. And three things happened there. And first thing is I got incredible mental clarity. Once you get away from a stressor, you go from stress mode to expansion and thoughtfulness. So I had incredible mental clarity. And the other thing I recognized was how happy I was. And I was like, wow, how can I be this happy? I didn't think it was actually possibly this happy, because I was in this like constant state of stress. And I said, well, if I'm this happy 1 week of the year and unhappy 51 weeks, that's like the tail wagging the dog. I'm like, this is all backwards. And then the third and final thing that happened, it was just miraculous, but there was a dream interpreter there. And that night, he said to me, remember your dreams, let's have breakfast and talk about it. So the dream I had that night was I was at a pool, and all the people I knew, friends, family, colleagues, are in the pool, squirting each other, splashing, having fun. I'm on the outside looking in this little glass portal. Well, it doesn't take a dream interpreter to recognize you feel your life's passing you by. So at that moment, I actually made the decision, I have to leave medicine. I just, if I can't be true to myself and do this, this is not what I was put on this earth to do. The hard part actually was telling my wife. And just so you know, this is my first wellness tip for you, right? If you're like on a romantic night with your spouse and then she's like whispering in your ear, like, honey, tell me those three words I love to hear. They're definitely not, I'm leaving medicine. First wellness tip, you can use that anytime you want. Not an aphrodisiac for like a year plus, okay? All right, so there I was. So I decided I had to leave medicine, and then I had to decide. Then the next step is, what am I going to do? Like, all I've been is a doctor all my life since the age of three, essentially, in my mind. And so what I did was I started to I left my medicine and I became a health coach. And I said, but what's my niche? What do I really have to do? There's a million health coaches out there. So I would go in Central Park and just walk and walk and walk and think. And what came to me was, what happened to me was, I was physically fine. I was, you know, had the life of my dreams, my good family. Everything was great. But I was essentially, what was happening is I was losing my life energy, my spirit, my soul, essentially. My soul was dying. And so I said, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to become a soul doctor. I'm going to help people who want to do better, know they can do better, want a better life, and want to align themselves with the incredible power of living by what, meeting all your needs and living by what your soul wants, not what society or your spouse or whatever wants you to do. So essentially now, that's what I do. I meet with clients, I meet with groups, I do some talking, and basically for those who want to do better, be better, go deeper, just have a more meaningful, powerful life, that's what I go to the park, figure it out for myself, see if it works, and then I share that with others. So essentially, my personal life and professional life have merged into one, which is just to wake up every morning and say, how do I make today an awesome day and tomorrow even better?
Sarah. Hi, I'm Sarah Stackpole, and I'm not going to give you an existential story. Sorry, Dan. So for those of you who may remember, I was a singer as one of my major activities while I was here at Amherst. And I had a lot of questions when I was contemplating going to medical school. I ended up taking a deferral, and I spent a year at Juilliard studying voice. I quickly realized I did not want a career as a waitress, so I went to medical school. And it took a while, but I ended up in ear, nose, and throat, and I became a voice specialist, the job of my dreams. I was so happy, and I was doing wellness for a large part of what I was doing because singers need to be well to function and sing well. If you're not well, you can't appear on Broadway at 8 o'clock at night and get paid. And if you don't sing, you don't get paid. I had experience with acupuncture as a resident. I herniated discs in my back, and it affected my ability to stand in the OR for long periods of time. And I was lucky we had a Chinese physician affiliated with Manhattan Eye and Ear, and he treated me. I was able to complete my residency. And after that, I would do it periodically. So everything was going great. And in 2010, I contracted meningitis. I was really sick. I developed life-threatening symptoms. I had vertigo. I developed double vision, which is permanent. It's improved. I was in and out of work and on disability for 5 years. Ultimately, I was going broke, so I closed my practice. My father was ill with metastatic cancer. I moved home to help to Elizabeth, New Jersey. And I, like Dan, contemplated, what am I going to do next? So I thought about teaching, but then I realized I would be a little frustrated if I weren't in healthcare in some way, and I thought back to my positive experiences with acupuncture. So I was lucky I found a specialized program training physicians in acupuncture. After I finished my certification, I started teaching there, but I really wanted to get back to ENT, and I also knew that there's a lot of interest in our society in not going right away to surgery. We want to maintain health. We want to minimize the use of medications. We want to maximize the use of herbs, supplements, energy, training techniques, relaxation techniques, acupuncture, yoga. And so I sought around, and I was lucky to connect with a colleague from residency, and I'm now back doing non-surgical ENT, starting to add a little acupuncture within it now that I'm getting going. But I think, and I also learned about aromatherapy, so there'll be a little of that coming too. But performers, which are my primary focus, it's all about wellness. So I embrace this, and I do it in my own life. I do stretching. I am happy because I'm doing what I can do that gives me joy.
Hi, I'm Eileen Rosen. I am not a doctor. Let's start there. And I've basically spent most of my adult life figuring out what I wanted to do. While I was figuring that out, I was raising three kids, doing some teaching, doing some freelance writing and editing, and all the while going to yoga class. I started yoga in 1996 with the first class, and I just loved it. And I loved it in part because of how I felt physically, and in part because it calmed me down emotionally, and it also brought mental clarity. I am the kind of person, as a lot of us probably are, who live in my head and can get pretty jumbled up in there. And after class, I would come out and things were calm and clear. So I just went along going to yoga, you know, once a week, maybe twice, until 2012, honestly, when I turned 50, and I decided that as a 50th birthday present to myself, I was going to do yoga teacher training. I didn't necessarily want to teach, but from going to class, I was learning that there was a whole philosophy behind the poses and the little bits of breathing and the little bits of chanting that I was doing in class, and I was really curious. So I did teacher training. It's a 200-hour program. And then I thought, well, I like little kids. I taught preschool, so if I'm going to teach anybody yoga, it will be kids. So I did children's training. And then I learned about a program near me called yoga therapy. I didn't know what it was not familiar with it, but I was just really drawn to it. I wasn't sure about it, and then one day I dropped my daughter off at gymnastics, which was kind of not too close to my house. I went looking for gas, and I passed the yoga studio where they did the this program. So I went in, and I talked to the head, and I signed up. I signed up for a year. I ended up doing the full program, which is 3 years. So it's kind of the equivalent of a master's, but it's through a yoga studio, not a school. So it's, you know, it's not accredited that way. And I finished that 2 years ago. And from there, I spent the last 2 years co-authoring two books with my teachers. So one was with my friend and teacher in children's yoga that's specifically for preschool teachers on bringing yoga and mindfulness into their classrooms. And the other is a much more general health book on maintaining a healthy lifestyle, including physical, mental, emotional, energetic, and spiritual from a yoga perspective. So most of you probably are not familiar with yoga therapy. As I said, I wasn't. It's a complementary wellness profession, meaning it can go along with healthy person, it can go along with PT, medical doctor, psychotherapy. Unlike yoga classes, it's done one-on-one, and it's very tailored to the individual. And it can be applied to pretty much any situation where you're feeling tension or unease, or as we like to say, dis-ease or disease. So just to give you an example, I had a client who was approaching retirement. And she had been very, very focused on her career. That's how she identified. That's where most of her time and energy went. And she was a little nervous about this, and she wanted to do it in as healthy way as possible. So we approached different areas in different ways. She had a lot of stiffness in her lower body, as many of us do who spend a lot of time at a desk. So we worked with poses to try to bring more mobility and more comfort into her lower body. She also, like many of us, wanted to lose weight. So we talked about what she would do, what appealed to her, what she would be able to stay motivated to in terms of fitness to meet those weight loss goals. She also had some anxiety about the work that she was doing and the change that she was contemplating. And so we did worked with breathing exercises that she could do with me to learn to control that, but also take with her and use at any time, which is all true for any breathing exercises you use. You don't have to go to yoga class. You can use them anytime. And also, as I said, there's a lot of yoga philosophy to just change your mental outlook. Many of us, we see things the way we see them, and we think that's the only way we can see them. But there's actually a lot of ways that you can learn to change your outlook. So we did all of those as a group. And I've also just, in my personal life, do this a lot. So this morning, I was stiff from a six-hour car drive, so I did a lot of poses. I was a little nervous about this presentation, so I meditated and did some breathing. Other days, I don't do very much. My point being that all of this is things that you can carry with you and use in whatever way suits you. So what I have finally decided now, you all know how old I am, is I'm going to be an independent education consultant, otherwise known as a college counselor, which brings together my interest in education, my interest in writing and editing with essays, and if any of you who have gone through this with your kids know, a lot of stress management. So we'll see how that goes.
Thank you. For those of you who are standing, if that is your way to stay healthy and well, keep standing. But for those of you who find sitting more conducive, please feel free to take a moment and find a seat so that you can be comfortable and enjoy the rest of our time together. I'm going to ask a question or two to get things started, but then I'm going to sort of open it up so that keep your questions. There'll be plenty of time for your questions of any of our panelists here. But I'm going to start a little bit with, so many people feel that they're so enmeshed in their current busy and stressful lives, and we've heard a little bit about that with each of our panelists. We're balancing careers, kids, parents' health needs, maybe our own health needs. And sort of we feel overwhelmed with all this information that's out there concerning health and wellness. So what would you say to somebody who kind of wants to improve their habits but doesn't really know where to start? And any of you can pick up on.
I'll jump in. So as I said, there's a lot of yoga philosophy, and it actually specifies your priority order in values in life. And number one is yourself. And that's number two is family, three is work, and four is community. And it's kind of the idea, the same idea as when they say in an airplane to put the oxygen on yourself first. If you don't take care of yourself, you cannot take care of everything else. You can for a while, but you burn out. And you, if you're me, you start forgetting things. If you're somebody else, you yell at people. You're not at your best. So the best advice is start with yourself, and you can start small. Hopefully that 2-minute breathing exercise helped you all a little bit, you know, or show you how you can change things. You can start with 5 minutes a day. Whatever the specific is depends on your life, you know, how things are going. But it's possible to start small, keep going, and really make significant change.
A couple of things. Ways to make a start. First of all, start exactly where you are. There's no reason, you start where you accept where you're at, no guilt, shame, and just say, I want to start here, and that's where you start yourself, and you accept that fully and just start making some changes. The second thing that I see in my practice is that a lot of people come to me and they say, I want to lose 30 pounds, and we end up working for very extended periods of time and really discussing what they eat doesn't come up. What comes up is the relationships at home, the stress at work, you know, how they feel about themselves. So when you want to start with something, don't start with something you think you should be doing, or you know, you're pressured, or society, or spouse is saying something to you about that. Start with what you are emotionally charged to start, because that's the one that you're going to have the momentum to make changes. And the final thing I would say is sign up for my newsletter. And I say this because while all of you are out there doing your jobs and take care of sick patients, take care of sick parents, or taking care of your children, or whatever you got to do, I'm out walking in the park just figuring out what to do with this stuff. And I literally do. I just wander around and I figure, you know, it comes down to how do you manage your emotions? How do you keep the good emotions and not listen to the ones that drive you down and make you negative? Huge. Just that alone makes a big change. How do you identify with what your needs are and then meet those needs? Like, we are out there doing all these things. Where's the time that we say specifically, like Eileen said, I'm taking care of myself now, because a drowning person can't save another drowning person, and you can't have the strength for two people when you need to offer that strength to other people until you take care of yourself. So any people who are affiliated with Amherst, alums, or families, the newsletter is free. For people who are not associated with Amherst, the newsletter's free. But I'll give you the first deal. So, and honestly, what I do is I make little, so I have little, like a little aha moment that I discuss that is relevant to what people I see are coming to me with, and then a few very quick practices, usually ones that take on the order of seconds every day to do, to bring in your life. You practice these things, you see if they work, and then the changes start. So if you're interested, you can talk to me after this panel.
I approach things, I mean, I totally agree with both of what my co-panelists have said, but many times I'm trying to get somebody through a crisis, particularly a performer. So there are two things I advise them to do. One, they need to review what's going on with themselves, and they shouldn't do it alone, in isolation. And so I suggest that they speak to a couple of people in their lives whose advice they trust, so when they come back, we'll have a little more direction. The second thing is that I help them pick out one or two of the most challenging things that they want to work on, which are usually things like quitting smoking or their acid reflux diet, both of which affect their voice, and we start to quantitate and identify things so they can do simple things, one thing at a time. And so with the cigarettes, I have them literally count and every couple of days try to get one less that they use, with the goal that they'll go on gum and patches and this to get off it. It's not a one-day activity. That's what I tell them. We'll be working on this probably for a year, but we can make progress. And with acid reflux, if any people have ever had it, I do use medication initially, but then it's a matter of figuring out food choices. And so people can't usually affect miraculous changes all at one time. But if you can take simple steps, you can make progress. And then when they come back and we're talking about the bigger life picture, as Eileen and Dan spoke about, then I can help guide them into other resources, because I can't do that for them very much. But their teacher, their counselor, their lifestyle coach, their yoga instructor can be part of the picture. But analyzing it and doing steps slowly, one at a time, I find really pays off.
Thank you. We come from a school, and we're part of a society that generally operates with traditional definitions of success. How would you measure success in the world of wellness? And how do they complement each other? And how do they compete against each other?
Are you both looking at me?
Well, that was a showstopper.
Well, I'll tackle it, because I have been through a terrible time when I felt like a failure. When I was sick and had to stop working, it was devastating. I felt like I had wasted my medical education. I couldn't function. So I will tell you that success is, for me, it's not about money. I put most of my retirement investments into trying to continue to work in conventional medicine, and it didn't work. So for me, success is being able to function and go about not only your daily activities, but to do activities that bring you satisfaction and even joy. And there's work, there's family, there's society, and I'm also a big fan of doing actual activities that keep you involved. So I'm still singing. I sing with a choral group, and it's one of the major things in my life. So that's what I get satisfaction from, is doing things and being involved and keeping myself off the street.
So
So I think that you need to define success. And, you know, I climbed the ladder of success to only find out that it was leaning against the wrong building. It's not mine. I just heard that recently, and I thought it was pretty much summed it up. And then I was, you know, and the irony was when I was most successful and I rose to as high as I was going to go in my profession, I was the least happy. And when I'm the least successful, as, you know, defined by my wife, I am the happiest I've ever been. And not only the happiest, but I realized that the experience I have in life is unlimited. The only thing limiting the experience any of us have in life are the thoughts we have. So all I have to do is change the thoughts and the experience entirely changes. So my idea of success is waking up in the morning and saying, what is the perfect day today? How am I going to be the best person I can be? How can I be of service to other people? And how can I make this world better? And, you know, first by turning off the news and then going inside. No, but really, instead of letting the world impact you, how about waking up and impacting the world? And it's so simple as just listening to somebody, you know, holding space, being present. And there's so much we can do. And guess what? It's what we were designed to do as a community. And the only reason that there's all this sickness and disease and suicide and anxiety and Prozac and opioid problems is that we're moving away from how we're designed to do. So my model of success is go back to the way it was. I always said, be a farmer in the 1880s. You get up in the morning, you have a little alone time, you go out in the fields and you work and you have physical labor, you're in the sun, you're in nature, you go home, you have a meal that comes from actual things that came from the farm, not from a machine, a processed plant. And then, you know, if you're lucky, you get lucky. And then what a perfect day. And what are we doing now? Nothing, none of that. We're on phones and digital and success and you know, Instagram followers, and we're just moving away from our DNA, and that's where the disease is coming from. So I say, let's go backwards in time. Let's say progress is going to be regression, and regression is progress, and you can give yourself everything you need. And I think that's success to me. You need to define it for yourself, and that's everyone's journey.
As I said, as primarily a, quote, stay-at-home mom for most of my 30s and 40s, I have a lot of experience with the tension between what I think is success and what I want to be doing and what the world around me seems to say. And I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room who feels that way. And I think that Sarah and Dan have spoken well about defining success for yourself. Again, from a yoga perspective, the comprehensive yoga therapy book has a chapter on work. And it's a lot about finding the intention in your work. So if you are working to make money, we all need to survive, you know, we all need to make a certain amount of money. But if you are working to make more money than the next person or to beat them out or to, you know, whatever it is, that's maybe not such a healthy intention. If your intention is to bring health and wellness to others, to just do something as well as you can do it, to be creative, to heal, all of those are intentions that can bring you a very satisfying work life, but that don't mean that you have to work 24/7 or you always have to be on your phone. It just gives you more permission to tune out the outside world when you need to and turn back into your own life, your own family, your own body, your own health.
So I have one more question for the panelists, and then I'm going to open it up to your questions. So we were talking a lot now about the definitions of success. If you're someone who feels they've achieved success and happiness, who enjoy their job and their life, are there things they can ask themselves that might help them work toward even more wellness? Are there ways to assess your degree of wellness to know if you're fooling yourself into believing you've arrived?
I'll go ahead. I don't know that you've ever arrived. You can always be more well, more healthy. But I also don't want to say that you're fooling yourself. You know, it's because then you're judging yourself and we don't want to go in that direction either. What's been really amazing to me with what I've learned is how I have learned through introspection and some structured questioning and meditation to notice the negative thoughts that I have from way, way back and how they're still influencing everything I do. So I hope this isn't too personal. If I walk into a room or in my reunion, I get nervous, I freeze, I look to go to the side, I look for one person, because part of me is still in seventh grade and still worried about how people are going to perceive me. And bringing that thought up to the surface, looking at it, realizing I'm not in seventh grade, I'm 56, you know, gives me the permission to just walk in and say hi and smile. And, you know, people smile back. It just, so whatever your issue is that you just think is part of you, if it's causing you any, as I said, unease, dis-ease, it is possible to notice it, work on it, and move through it.
I had a different take on this question, although I enjoyed what you said, Eileen. When Robin sent this to me, I thought about, well, what can we do to do more? And I happened to read at that time a very interesting review of a book by an author I had read before, David Brooks. I'd read his works on character, and I commend his book on character to you. But it was a review in the New York Times, and what he titled his book was called The Second Mountain. And he based it on attending a funeral and listening to a eulogy about the person's life. And he described realizing that at the end of our lives, what do we have? We have our relationships. We have what we have accomplished. But it's not about money usually. It's about what else did you do? Did you support your local homeless shelter? Did you tutor children? So I think a lot of what we're looking forward to at the age that our class is what else do I want to do as part of myself as an individual that I can give or achieve that adds more to what I think of worth in my life, not money, but other activities that either are good for me or my family or my community. What kind of legacy do I want to look back on?
So first of all, I want to commend Eileen for a beautiful and brave statement about what she talked about and something we all go through and hide. And is I just think that the process of what she did is actually the path of wellness. It's just saying, yeah, I have these crazy, stupid feelings. I mentioned it before. How do you live by the emotions that you keep, the emotions you like, and get rid of ones that are not serving you? And that is that's why I think that you never can arrive to anything, because you can always go deeper with that. My opinion is that anytime you've arrived somewhere and you're not going to move from there, you're 6 feet under, and that's your final destination. And I say that facetiously, but it's also kind of serious, because the growth, it's the growth, it's the pushing through fear, it's the taking risks, it's all this, it's getting out of your comfort zone that is the process of being well. Of there's no time you ever can sit on your laurels and say, like, I got it, I got this thing down, because it doesn't exist. The minute you stagnate, you therefore have given up the path of wellness. And that is, you know, I think you've heard all of us talking about the whole idea of just doing better, being better, and it could be, you know, tiny, tiny little doses of doing that. So, I would just answer the question that, yes, you're fooling yourself, quite honestly, because what I think the difference, the word you're actually probably we're talking about is the word complacency. And I think complacency is a really dangerous place to hang out, because that is when you are saying, yeah, things are good enough. I'm really really what you're saying is I'm not in enough pain to do anything different. I'm getting enough aliquots of pleasure in my life. But what you're missing is what I mentioned before, is that there is no limits to the amount of experience and meaning and power you can have in your life. So if you're not always reaching for more, you're missing out on something. And I would say that's someplace you don't want to be.
Nice. What are your questions? Comments? Yes, sir.
How much meditation should you do, once a day or
There are standard answers, and then there's individualizing it for each person. So the classic is usually about 20 minutes a day. Meditation can take different forms. Most people are familiar with mindfulness now. There's chanting. Prayer is a form of meditation. But at the same time, if you're at a stage of life where you can't do 20 minutes a day, do 10. I went through a period of chanting works for me, of doing 20 minutes in the morning, kept it up for a while. It was kind of amazing. I can't always do that. I've started chanting in the car. It's not the same because I have to pay attention to driving. But
she's heading home tomorrow afternoon. If you're heading out, just kidding.
My eyes are open. No, it's fine. But it brings me a little bit of calmness. And what I found is, again, just kind of studying your own mind, that often in the car I would end up having arguments with people. So I'm sitting in the car, nothing's wrong, everything's fine, but I'm angry because I'm, you know, at whoever, someone I'm working with, you know, someone in my family, whatever. So now instead of doing that, or listening to the news, which, you know, get a little bit of news once a day, that's it. That's my big advice. But instead of doing something negative like that, I'm calming myself. And so that's what works for me many days.
I would say that, first of all, the minute you say meditation and should in the same sentence, you've already killed your meditation. and I'm not joking about that. I was in that process, and it was once I flipped an internal switch where I actually, like, I'm bouncing out of bed to get to meditation, I realized now I'm meditating. Because the whole idea of meditation, and it really is this incredibly complex thing, you could talk about this forever, but it, you know, studies show at about 20 minutes your brain waves start to shift. So really getting to about 30 minutes is, and then doing it twice a day it's reinforced. So, but again, to start meditating, you should not start that. You should start with tiny amounts, 1 and 2 minutes, and then a 5 minutes. It shouldn't be something that should take away from your day. It should be until you're drawn into doing it. The other thing about it is, it can take on so many different forms. But I think either in the meditation or outside the meditation, what's really powerful is having some personal reflection time. And when you do that, you're actually looking at your life and saying, what is it you need to do for next steps? But I think that without the component of meditation, a lot of what we're talking about is difficult. Because, again, who are you going to rely on to make these decisions for you if you're not coming up with them from yourself and from a still position? And, you know, that's where the power of healing yourself comes from.
Yes.
Sure.
Can everybody hear the question? She said, I sit all day. Can we talk about walking meditation?
I have done it. I don't personally practice it, but basically the point of it is to walk focusing inward and trying, I'm thinking of two different types of meditation now. Thich Hanh Nhan does a lot of walking meditation. You can look him up on the internet. He's a Vietnamese monk in the U.S. The other thing that you can do is something, it's called forest bathing. It's just getting out in nature. And that can also, as Dan said, be very calming for a lot of people. So just taking a quiet walk where you're not counting your steps and you're not trying to achieve anything, you're just walking quietly, calmly. And if you're doing it in nature, really notice what's going on around you. You can just stare at a leaf for a section and notice the patterns on the leaf. Or you can try to keep your mind quiet inward, but most of us have a very hard time keeping our minds just perfectly quiet.
So,
Mark?
Well, yes,
that
makes a huge difference.
Yeah, and even beyond that, you know, sitting by itself in stand-up desks doesn't really negate this. Sitting all day in itself is actually one of the biggest risk factors for health. And so probably a great idea would be to meditate for a short period in the morning about how you need to sit less. And what I do now is I've entirely flipped it. I used to like sit all day and then do a little bit of exercise. Now I pretty much move all day and I sit when I need to rest. And that may be seen as extreme, but it actually is really wonderful because the energy is constantly always moving and I get to eat whatever I want. But the thing is, there's a lot of things you can take to be moving. So when I take all my phone calls outside, when I meet friends, I don't meet for meals anymore, we're walking. So there's a way of just, again, the technology has hampered us. You have to go back to the way we were designed. And there was an article in the New York Times showing that movement, frequent, almost nonstop movement is embedded in our DNA. It was like 2 weeks ago. So we got to go back to that. So two things to think about, perhaps.
Ma'am?
Thank you for sharing your remarkable, very personal journeys. In listening to you, it reinforces to me how much purpose is a component of wellness. And I think we're of those generations where the paradigm that our parents had is very different for us, but it's still somewhat uncharted waters. Do you have thoughts on that? Because it's something I think a lot of us struggle with, how to redefine purpose in our 50s, 60s.
Yeah, I think that is the question. I mean, that is the, that yes, we are done. Why don't you take this one? But the bottom line is what I think of is what was I put on earth to do? I literally think about that, you know, while everyone else is like binging Netflix, I'm like thinking about that, you know, and I really feel like, you know, it wasn't the path I had taken and I had to make a radical change. And because I did it, I'm constantly in integrity with my body, mind, and soul. Like everything's just clicking together because it's all aligned. It's not like I should do this, it's that, what about there's, so let's go back to meditation. Let's go back to wellness. Let's go back to your question. These are all the areas that we're not spending enough time reflecting on to figure out. You can get help with this. You can get a mentor. You can discuss it. You can get a friend. You can get a coach. There's a lot of things to do. But I'll tell you, the deep work, the heavy lifting is in your heart. And I think everyone, what I would love for everyone just to leave here realizing is that each of us as individuals have incredible power to impact ourselves, our friends, our community, and the world. And we live small. I lived small my whole life. I made the commitment not to do that anymore. To fill my purpose. Everyone has one. Everyone has skills. Each one of you have a unique set of skills, experience, training, and background that only you have. Think about that. So what do you want to do with that in the time you have left? Because the clock is ticking. And you know, remember that.
Since,
you know,
age three.
Well, yeah. That's right. That's right. Come on, you guys are like all older than three, you know, you get this? So the bottom line is, you know, I really take this, I take humor seriously, and I take my serious, you know, and I just combine it all that this is it. Spend time figuring out, and you will, and there's a lot of ways to do it.
I have a comment about that as well. I personally feel, and I'm struggling it with my now widowed mother, it really helps in seeking for purpose not to just look within yourself, but to find something that you can do that gives you a motivation to get out of bed, to go interact with other people, to have an activity that has some worth in and of itself. My mother lost my father last year, Amherst 52. after 60 years of marriage. She doesn't know what to do with herself. She's still healthy. I'm like, volunteer with this. Do this. Try that. I can't get her to do anything. And I know she would be a lot happier. She used to be a doctor. She was pretty happy when she was going to work. She has no purpose now. So what I find is doing things that involve me with other people and have worth in and of themselves make a big difference in having a sense of purpose that I want to do this for such and such to achieve a positive result, whether it's volunteering at the homeless shelter or, you know, being, you know, delivering flowers at the hospital, whatever. It doesn't matter, but it gives you a reason to get involved.
Or just listening to the person who's trying to tell you something next to you. It doesn't have to be you have to, like, you know, go somewhere and go to a hospital and see sick little kids. It really is being present and being patient as much as you possibly can and being aware of that. It's very smart.
So a hand up in the back here. I'm going to repeat the question for some in the front who may not have heard it. It's she's asking about, as parents, how can we instill a sense of wellness or practice of wellness in our children? And I'll let the...
I'll start. It's. I know you have specific issues. Many people's kids struggle with anxiety. It's rampant. That's not news to anyone, I'm sure. And it's a huge topic. The internet definitely has something to do with it, but I would say that for the purposes of right now, to focus on your own sense of wellness, because the greatest power that you have is to model it for your children and to also get a handle on your own anxiety and emotions, because you communicate that anxiety, we all communicate that anxiety to them. So that's a piece of it, and it bounces back and forth. And if you can learn to control your own, then when they get anxious, you're not causing this, you know, frenzy. You can stay as a calm, steady support to let them calm themselves. Beyond that, as I said, there are a lot of specifics, a lot of issues, that, and many different experts to be involved.
I think I totally agree with that. So, I've told my daughter a million times what I think she should be eating, and guess how that went for me. thank God she still talks to me. And actually, it's real funny. Like a week ago, we had a walk in the park, and she was telling me like how that has still impacted her life at this point. And you know, she just graduated college. And I got it because I remember all the things my parents told me, and basically, you know, how you just run the other way. But the other thing I think that's important to do, so it's role modeling. But as you role model, as Eileen did so beautifully, it's calling out your own stuff. That's a good word, stuff. Calling it out. So I'm feeling anxious over how you're doing at school, and you know that makes me feel uncertain. But I know that we'll get through it together. So you're calling it out. You're bringing it to the surface, and then you're bringing safety and comfort and security back into it. Like it's a feeling, and we're going to get through it. And that's how you model it. But also, don't model it silently. Verbalize it, demonstrate it, and kind of, you know, really make it big so it can't be missed, especially for younger kids.
Did you have a quick follow-up?
About that, because because it goes beyond me modeling it to some degree.
You mean addressing the anxiety that goes to it? It's the same. I mean, it's ultimately the same as you would do with any anxiety for any. The cause is not important. It's the fact that anxiety is a reaction to fear. You know, 99.999%, it's BS. That fear is a fear and not a real threat. Like, you know, it's so funny because ironically, you know, anxiety is put on this to make us survive. And back in the day, we really helped us survive. We're all here, right? But now anxiety is actually leading us to die earlier and younger. And it's so ironic. So we need to now flip it again and say, how do I get rid of this anxiety? And the source is less important than it is the methods. How to reduce anxiety is a workshop, and so we can't really get to it. But it's the same thing as any anxiety. You you have to know when to seek professional help and when to do all this wellness stuff that you can do on your own. That's a judgment call also, and you may want to seek professional help in making that decision too.
Yes, sir.
I wonder whether the panelists could speak to some more to the science behind mindfulness and presence and all. I've talked a bit with doctors or mental health professionals about some amazing study results linking health benefits, about the parasympathetic nervous system and things like that. I wonder if you have anything to add on those points.
Specifically how to activate the parasympathetic system or... Yeah, I always think that's so funny that people love when there's a scientific study showing them that they feel better. You know, I think that's so funny because I came from science and the only reason like I do these talks is like, and I always start my talks the first half of all the science in which I was like, who the hell cares, you know? I feel better, I know I'm more alive, I have more energy, I'm a better person. Oh, but you know, look at this study now, it's true and people rely on it and I think moving away from the science really would help, you know? I think that you got, again, you know, I have these little phrases, you know, as I'm wandering in the forest alone, with my dog, actually. That's a wellness tip, too, by getting a dog. But I have these little phrases, and now I believe them, I have faith in them, and I call them Danisms. And one of my, guess where I got that from, right? And one of them is be your best own doctor, psychiatrist, coach, confidant, and friend. And the reason I say that is that we have needs, right? And we look to others for needs, right? So we look for our spouses, I hope our friends are gonna treat us, and I hope our bosses are kind to us. But the bottom line is they're all busy with their own worries and fears and anxieties. So there's nothing constant, there's nothing consistent with that. So I have a practice in the morning, it's about 90 seconds, where I actually fulfill every need I have, and then it's like 8:01, and I'm already had a great day, and doesn't matter what happens after that. You mean, it's funny, it's ridiculous. You know, my father once saw me do it, and he said, oh, there he is praying to the gods again. But it actually works, because we all have certain things we need, but we're seeking, you know, it's like Elton John says, looking for, trying to drink whiskey out of a bottle of wine is what essentially we're all doing. So trust your heart and your intuition. If it feels good, if you are good, if you're doing good, it's good.
There's a lot of interesting literature about this, about regulation of our system that comes out of the acupuncture treatments for addiction. The protocol is called the NADA protocol. It was developed at Montefiore, and it primarily focuses on ear acupuncture. The interesting thing is the ear acupuncture is highly effective because the vagus nerve, which is the nerve that goes to our internal organs, has an outlet to the skin in the center of the ear skin. So this is where this is coming through. And more recently, I've been reading literature out of the interleukin literature, cytokines. I spent a year in that lab, so I actually do understand some of the basic science of this. But a very interesting researcher, Kevin Tracy, is now showing that vagal stimulation not only affects motion of our internal organs and things like that that we knew through smooth muscle signaling that nerves do, right? They're now showing that it modulates how cytokines are produced, and cytokines are highly involved in our body's reaction to inflammation, in physiologic markers like blood pressure. And so he has started doing papers on, can we treat things like autoimmune diseases and high blood pressure and arthritis, all of which are modulated by our body, by neural stimulation. He is a neuroscientist, a neurosurgeon trained at Cornell, and was ahead of me in this lab, and his thoughts are amazing on the subject. But they are starting to find basic science reasons why activating the parasympathetic system, which is our which is part of our nervous system that works on relaxation, as opposed to the sympathetic system, which is our fight or flight and raises our blood pressure, our anxiety levels, our stress levels, but allows us to respond to emergencies. But parasympathetic stimulation is helping our bodies auto-regulate and down-regulate the harmful side effects. I hope that helps.
I'm going to just add one thing. I agree with both of them. We all, in my opinion, we've been trained to look outside of ourselves for health and tell me what to do, when really a lot of the information is internal. I won't say all of it, but a lot of it. At the same time, the science is there. So I'm going to recommend a book. It's called Calm Clarity by a woman named her first name is D-U-E, last name is Kuach, Q-U-A-C-H, and it does a really good job of outlining the science alongside a really incredibly compelling personal story.
Well, it seems our time has already come. I hope each of you have taken something away from this panel so that you can live and function well in body, spirit, and community. Thank you very much for listening.
I'm looking for my purse.
Want to do it? I think we're well past our time. So.